Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and PT pearls to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in.
All right, so I'm so excited to hop into this episode because I get to share a lot of my journey and kind of my movement journey into some of the restrictions in my body. And in that discussion comes up Vivo Barefoot Shoes. And this is something that you've heard Jen and I talk about if you've listened to our stuff or watch any of our stuff on Instagram, because it truly is the only pair of shoes that we wear. And just in the last year and a half of me wearing these shoes, like the way these shoes are thin, flexible, and wide, they really challenge my feet, but help them grow into themselves and their ability to connect into the ground. So just after a year and a half of wearing these shoes, I feel so much better in my body, so much better in my feet. And we have a link in the show notes. You can get 15% off any of your pair of Vivo Barefoot shoes. And the other amazing thing is you have 100 days to try these things out and see how they work with your feet. And you can still return them or try a different pair of shoes at the end of that if you're not completely satisfied. So check these things out while you're listening to the episode. Go to the link and check out your Vivo Barefoot shoes to free your feet.
We've had a code change, so make sure you use code TOB so that you get 15% off. That is TOB, like the Optimal Body Podcast. Welcome back to another PT Pearl. I am really excited about this one because I get to interview you, babe. Mm-hmm. And this was really spurred on this idea to dive into your own journey and dive into mine, because I remember you were lying down, kind of adjusting your neck, and you said for a moment, like, I kind of want to get an image of my neck. Yeah. And we're going to go into why and, you know, the story behind that a little bit. But it's just, I think, being able to bring this to people, humanize the fact that, yes, we're PTs and we're talking about the body, but we're going through our own journey as well.
And something that we preach all the time is that, like, the image doesn't equal the pain, or the image doesn't equal your symptoms, or you can, regardless of what the image looks like, you can still make improvements. So that's where coming and saying, why would I get to this point where I'm saying, I want to get an image of my neck? And just knowing that it's a really frustrating place that a lot of people get to in their own, like, journeys and stuff. And there are some things that I've been going through in mind that I'm like, hey, the way that I move my neck, or the way that I crank at my neck to try and get relief, is that going to make it worse? And so I think that's a question that always gets in the back of people's minds once they've been having a pain point for a long time, or if it gets worse and they're not sure why. So
yeah, or if they're cracking something over and over, is this bad?
Yeah,
is this, you know,
right?
Yeah.
So I don't know, where should we start?
Well, I just want to, like, go over your background real quick. Like, what is your athletic background? Because it might not be the same as everyone, but I think there are similarities in what people can relate to and where you came from.
I think that I would relate closest in my movement to a lot of what I call sprint athletes, people who are always up on their toes, you're always on the balls of your feet, always launching your body. People like track athletes, sprinters specifically, and jumpers, basketball, football, baseball, where it is, it's usually short bursts of movement. And so I was always up on my toes and what we call real powerful movements, which is fast. You know, you're just moving at a fast velocity usually. So I was in a lot of those sports, and that required me, or pushed me, towards the weight room, right? Mm-hmm. Or a traditional weight room setting growing up. More so for, like, you know, football and basketball, they're just like, you need to get strong. So I did a lot of lifting, and I loved lifting legs. So I loved squats because I was bigger and I had bigger legs, and so I could always squat a lot or power clean a lot. And so that's kind of where I would find my initial movement kind of developed, was from these more explosive sports.
Mm. That's funny, because you heard, at least I heard growing up, it was like men never did legs. It was always upper body.
Oh, and I was completely the opposite, because I was pretty thin and lanky up on top. So I was always a little bit, like, percentage wise or ratio wise, a bit weaker on the upper body lift. So I loved leg day.
That's so funny.
I was kind of flip flopped, which I think had benefits for me. You know, we're going to talk a little bit through where I think some of that stuff caused some compensations in my patterns throughout life that I kind of carry with me now. But again, I think there's a lot of benefit to this way that I developed as well.
Yeah. And just a little bit of a humble brag, you did do college football as well.
And again, I played at the Division III level, which is, you know, the lower of the NCAA levels of college football. But what I would think was very competitive ball. I was pretty good in high school as far as my team went. And I thought Division III football was very competitive. So had a lot of fun doing that. I'd say one of my biggest prideful moments from college football is that I played in 40 out of 40 games that I was at college. So all 40 games that we had, I played on the field in and wasn't injured, wasn't, you know, sidelined during any of those. So regardless of how good I was consistent and I was on the field contributing for my team, you know?
Yeah, no, that's really impressive.
So that was one of my things I took away is I did have things that were bumps and bruises, but I always managed to keep my body in playing shape at least.
Yeah. Well, let's go back now. When was the first injury that you ever had?
I think so. We'll love talking into this. One of my very first injuries was, I'd say I remember hamstring first, actually. I remember hurting my hamstring when I was in middle school track, kind of what they'd call a hamstring pull, you know, right up low in the butt cheek. And I'm like, okay, why am I having this hamstring issue? It kind of came back a couple times. And I think that's, you know, was my onset of now thinking back, realizing, wow, I was way overusing my hamstrings and not using my glutes, right? And I tended to sit in this way anterior pelvic tilted position, which, you know, as a sprinter, as a sprint athlete, I wanted all that tension in my hamstrings so I could feel nice and powerful. The problem being when I put all of the power through my hamstrings, I got myself into some issues there. At least that's what I'm thinking about myself going back.
Yeah.
Next issue, kind of funny because it goes right along with this. I started having issues with my hernia, you know, with an inguinal hernia when I was a junior in high school,
which
is where we have all this fascia and all these tissues that kind of hold in the stuff in our low abdomen. And when we don't handle our pressures too well, kind of in our between our pelvic floor, our abdominal muscles, I was putting a lot of pressure towards the front of my abdomen. And so I was getting actually a little bit of poofiness out of my inguinal area, which is right around my groin, showing that I had a hernia, which is a protrusion through kind of the fascial tissues in your low abdomen. So my very first hallmark sign that I was having pressure issues in my core. That was junior year of high school, the first time I had an actual surgery.
Wow.
So I was 17 when I had my first surgery for hernia.
And what did they do?
So they inserted mesh bilaterally in my inguinal area to kind of patch up where there were these fissures or where there were these deficiencies. And so then it was fixed, right? Because then the hernias couldn't pop through there. So they put these meshes in.
And what did you experience after that? Like, was it fixed? Did you have more hernias? Anything else?
So, one, the recovery from surgery was not, you know, super pretty because you then had all of the surgery right where all your abdominal muscles attached. So, anytime
and
you
still
coughed
playing football.
Well, I was getting, you know, I had to rehab but get back into baseball actually at that point because I was going into the baseball season. But yeah, so they had put in these meshes and just the recovery process itself, I had to get used to. Every time I coughed, I had pain in my low abdomen and stuff. And so that just was for about a month kind of working out of that. But then for a few years afterwards and even into college, I had different pelvic pains, you know, what I'd call different low abdominal or pelvic pains that felt really similar to the first time I had the hernia. And I would tell my dad, who's a physician, if you're listening, I would tell him, I'm like, I think I'm having that hernia thing again. And he'd be like, okay, whatever, you know, maybe we can have you go get checked. And they would check and, oh, nothing's there. So still, yeah, the mesh got put in and they fixed it, but I was still having a lot of the same symptoms.
Yeah, they fixed it. They fixed what the symptom was, but not the cause. And you never went to a physical therapist or a pelvic floor therapist to really work with anyone.
No, I've still never seen a pelvic floor physical therapist or anyone in particular for that. I never got any actual consultation on how to prevent myself from putting the pressure in the same place or what caused that hernia. No one ever kind of talked through that with me. Like, oh, maybe you should do your core exercises a little different because you're, you know, directing your pressures a little suboptimally. Like that would have been nice for me to hear a lot sooner than I did.
For sure. And have you suffered other pelvic floor issues as a result? Because I think, and this gets a little personal, right?
Oh,
but
yeah,
at the same time, as men, I think we get to hear that men suffer pelvic floor and pressure issues as well. Like you hear it all the time for women, right? Especially with pregnancy and all this other stuff. But, and then that's when I want to address, like you also self-diagnosed diastasis recti.
Yeah. And I think it's really valuable, and I'll dive in, why not, about some like what we would call different pelvic floor or different abdominal pressure issues, because a lot of guys do deal with this. And I've had guys come to me that I played football with on my team that have asked me, you know, why am I leaking, or why am I having, you know, issues with incontinence? Why do I suddenly have urge symptoms and stuff like that? And so I do think there's a lot more people that have these types of symptoms that go silent for a long time. And then we get to this place where we've compensated way too much and have a lot more difficulties taking care of it. So I think, you know, one, due to a lot of the pressure problems I had, I developed a lot of low back symptoms because I would put a lot of pressure into my low back. And along with that, I think I developed different issues with pelvic floor control and contraction, because again, I think that's where I was missing a lot of my canister support, was in the pelvic floor area. And I think I kind of used and abused my pelvic floor for a while. So the diastasis recti that you brought up, I get a little bit of the poofiness kind of above my abdomen area. So yes, that's a something that most pregnant women might see. But again, a lot of men and a lot of older men that I see, I notice have some degree of this as well. So again, not just something that pregnant women will experience.
And then, when do you see the poofiness? And that, guys, if you aren't as familiar, it's just the separation of that abdominal wall.
Yeah.
And we have our linea alba, which is our fascial lining that kind of connects that sheath of those abdominals. And when we're putting extra pressure forward into that area, we can get a little bit of a gapping. And not necessarily bad. I mean, obviously, it all depends on function, right? So incontinence, like you brought up, like, are you noticing that you leak a little bit in terms of peeing yourself a little bit, especially with jumping, running, laughing, those kinds of activities?
So mine has never been that type of incontinence where I jump and I'll leak. The things that I experience with my symptoms will be more like I'll start exercise and then all of a sudden it's like, man, I need to go right now. Otherwise, you know, I'm not going to make it. And so mine is more what I would call an urge type thing. And I notice when that happens, I tend to go into this position of where my body wants to react and go in this position of guarding, where I'll extend through my low back and lock up. And really, then I'll do what my body always has done, and I'll not support through my low abdomen and my pelvic floor. When in reality, the thing that generally helps with both that and some of the other things that we're probably going to dive into is if I return to a really good centered breath, that kind of draws my ribs down, shows me to just tuck into that pelvic floor a little bit, I can feel those urge symptoms kind of recede. And so that's been a cool thing for me to work through, having stages where I feel like that thing controls me versus now I have the tools to, if I feel something come on, I can do a couple of things and take control back from it, right? So that's a cool thing that, you know, some people that might experience this might not feel like they can control those urges that come up. And I promise you that there are ways that we can influence our physiology to take back control or have some influence over those symptoms.
100%. And sometimes, you know, I think we've been taught so much too that it's like Kegel, 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 and just squeeze, squeeze, squeeze. First of all, you don't know if what you're actually squeezing. Like, some people think they're squeezing, they're actually bearing down. And then two, if you're already super tight and locked up down there, because maybe you are in more of a anterior or posterior pelvic tilt, like you have different positional positions, your body might already be super tight. And so just trying to contract on top of a super tight thing is not really going to be efficient. And that itself could cause a lot of leaking. So
totally. I find one of the things that helps me the most sometimes, and again, this is a personal thing, is when I take a nice solid breath in my nose and focus on that expansion of the low rib cage. Because what that does, if I'm thinking physiologically, it expands and contracts my diaphragm, and it actually pushes down into my pelvic floor, which, if it's overactive, causes it to eccentrically kind of lengthen and load. And for me, that's something that gives me a little like, oh, okay, we're okay here.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. It just helps to balance out that pressure and have that natural relaxation response so that we can naturally kind of contract without having to like, am I kegeling? Am I squeezing in enough? And ultimately, and I think it would be cool, Dom, if you as well went to see a pelvic floor therapist and then we can do this podcast again and like really see, you know, what have you been working on? What do your therapists find? And what are some of the tools that people can take away from that kind of journey?
For sure. And I think that it's cool that we kind of touched on this because foundationally now it's the thing that I probably work on the most, you know, even with what I'm, the high level stuff that I'm working on, this is still my weak link. So this is still the thing that I'm progressing at the, you know, pace of the hardest thing that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Right. But my other compensations are kind of because of this, I think, you know, yeah. is that this is one of my foundational things that a lot of my other more peripheral compensations or at my shoulders and down through my wrists and even down through my ankles, you know, have to do a lot with what was going on centrally.
Which is exactly what we preach as therapists, yeah. right? Get the center, get your core stabilized so that what happens at the extremities can start to work and everything move better.
Totally.
Which is probably why you've had some of the other external extremity issues that you've had. Yeah. I mean, I know we've touched on some of your knee stuff, but you want to just kind of touch on it again?
Yeah, so both of my knees, I've had issues kind of in the, what we would say, the medial compartment or the inside of the knees with the meniscus, which we had a podcast episode on. They're just the two padding things. They look kind of like half moons that are on the insides of our knees. And I have torn and had surgery on one of them and have similar symptoms on the other one that I've never had an image or surgery on and had recurring issues kind of come back into the right one. And so again, I think that's one of the things where I kind of always compensated in my core and it caused me to position a little differently through my knees when I would go into squat and hinge patterns so that my knees would fall slightly inside where my feet were and I would put a lot more pressure through that inside compartment of the knee.
For sure.
Yeah.
And so has that held you back from some of the lifting or some of the exercises that you want to do or rock climbing? Yeah. Has that held you back and what are you doing right now?
I think more so than holding me back, one of the things I would say is that it has helped me start to be way more conscious and mindful mm-hmm. of the things that I'm doing. So I'm not doing things that are beyond my ability right now. Because when I do, I'll twist my knee in a weird spot and my knee will lock and I won't be able to extend it all the way. And if I'm climbing 30 feet up in the air, that's a little scary when my knee suddenly locks.
Yeah.
So it just does make me be a lot more cautious. And sometimes it'll be a little frustrating because the things that I think should be easy, like jumping in sand or making a cut in sand, is something that's really tough for me right now.
Yeah.
So if someone asked me to go play beach volleyball right now, it is like, wow, I would always want to go play beach volleyball before, but am I going to have a lot of issues in my knee jumping and cutting around in something that's unstable? That's kind of tough.
So what have you been working on in order to get back to that place? Because I think that is a place, like you're saying, that you want to get back to.
Absolutely. And I don't think that is a place I can't go back to, which is, I think, the blessing of my company and you and the people that are around me. I know I can train my body back to that. And so a lot of what I'm doing now is integrating my core stability that I work on so much with higher level hip and knee movements, right? So you take something like a pistol squat, which is a single leg squat, right? And then I raise my heel, which puts a lot more pressure through my knee. And then I'm doing a single leg pistol squat with the heel raised. You know, that's something that puts my right knee on an island and makes it do a lot of work and makes it control a lot. And so, you know, I might integrate something like that into how I train now or do the task, go to the sand, do some controlled jumping drills in the sand, what we'd call plyometrics. You know, sometimes when I wake up in the morning, I'll go over to the sand and I'll do some jumping drills or do some animal flow in the sand because I know that's going to challenge me a little more to be aware of the knee. So after controlling in that controlled or training in that controlled environment, if I go and have a competition or play a game on the sand, I might be more prepared to succeed and not hurt myself.
Yeah.
If that all makes sense.
Are there other mobility restrictions that you're working on as well?
Yeah. And then when we go back to foundation, like that's before I'm doing all this other stuff, right? I'm working on the foundational mobility that my hips chronically tight, which is why I think is one of the reasons I compensated with so much low back motion and so much pelvic motion. My hips couldn't do it, so my pelvis and my low back would compensate, right? Same with my knees. My knees would do slightly more because my hips would hit their limit, and then my knees would have to compensate a little bit, which is a product of how my squat. I was so wide with my squat that my hips were as wide as they could get, but my knees would still kind of fall just inside my feet, even though it's like, oh yeah, I'm keeping my hips activated. It was still, you know, bumping up against the limits of the knees. So I do think that
Hip mobility has been a huge thing for me. The 90-90 position is something that I probably integrate daily. Ankle mobility, something I probably am doing daily, if not every other day. And some sort of shoulder or thoracic spine mobility, which is funny because those are all the places in the body you should be fairly mobile. And that's where I have most of my restrictions.
Exactly. I mean, but that's why it's like, and you don't know your body until you actually assess it. I mean, how many times do I have to say this, right? Yeah. Don't guess, assess.
Yeah. And so I think I hit this period in PT school. I was getting out of college. And again, in college, like, and this isn't a brag because I think thinking back, I wish I would have lifted a lot less weight, but I squatted 585 pounds in a back squat. I cleaned 385 in a power clean, clean and jerk about 335. So it's like I was putting these inordinate amount of weight on my back or over my head. And if I can think now of the different places that I was compensating, the amount of forces I was putting through my knees and my low back and my shoulders, doesn't surprise me that I've had some issues there. So as soon as I hit PT school, I'm like, wow, I really right now get to start focusing on some of these places I've been compensating. And I really have never returned since to trying to lift a maximum weight. I'm more so just trying to now control my body weight really well through all of the ranges that I might need to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when did your neck, when did you notice like your neck starting to become problematic?
So I think that that stems back to college back squatting. There were a few instances that I had like real bad stingers or real bad things kind of pop out of doing a traditional back squat or a really heavy back squat. And I just had this instance where I kind of collapsed on a back squat. That was a heavy one, had this really bad pain, mid thoracic type area on more on the left side. And, you know, it lasted 6 to 8 days, kind of went back down. I was like, whatever. It was a little bit irritating, but kind of just got back into playing and lifting again. And that was a instance that I started, you know, remembering this recurring pain, kind of like upper thoracic, low cervical on my left side. And, you know, since then, it's just been, okay, move, get my neck to crack a couple times, and then it goes away. And, you know, it's once that starts happening for 6 months, a year, 2 years, and it starts coming back, and then it starts moving up the neck into the ears or causing into headaches or going down into the low back on the left side, that's when you're like, okay, what the heck's actually going on here? And so that is something that started living with me a little bit. And I started realizing, oh, this kind of just is a recurring and a returning thing. And then we started learning a lot about these chronic pain patterns in PT school. So I'm like, well, this is a blessing for me because now I get to experience and work through this on my own and also maybe have something to, you know, understand or a little bit more relate to what a patient is feeling when they're going through their own journey.
100%. And that's kind of where that conversation, you know, of being interested or curious, like, should I get an MRI? I mean, why did that come up for you in a place that you felt like maybe that's necessary?
And then I would say comes one of the second instances as to why I know I have neck pain and carry neck trauma. I got in a really bad car accident and had a really, you know, significant head injury. Number two, I also played college football and had a lot of hits in the head and rattled the neck around. And something that I've always thought of being a PT is I know there's, and I say this, like, I know there's probably something wrong on an image with my spine. Based on my history, traumatic-wise, the car accidents, all of the head hits, I wouldn't be surprised if something showed up, even if I didn't have symptoms, right? I would say that, you know, based on studies and stuff of the prevalence of people with things that'll show up positive on images and whatnot. But I was also having these significant painful symptoms and things that would come up that I would consider are like debilitating. Like I can't do my normal work without having this thing affect my functioning, you know, or affect how I'm functioning and the quality of my function. So that's where I'm like, is me cracking my neck in a really, you know, intense position and pushing on my neck, pushing into something that is damaged, right? And that's something that flashes into people's mind, like, oh, is constantly cracking my neck hurting me more? And so again, kind of how we started this podcast, I was laying there like, man, should I get an image now so that things don't keep going down this road? And then I realized something is wrong. And so
it is, you know, to an extent, that flash of fear, like, oh, I feel like I'm doing something good because it's relieving my symptoms, but am I actually potentially making this worse?
Right.
Yeah.
So where have you kind of landed with it all?
You know, I think that I kind of go back to what's most rational to me, which is how I'm feeling and what changes that. And I know that there are a few things that I can do that changes the way that I feel, right? And that's the most empowering thing as me, just as a person, but also as a provider, when I see patients realize, oh, I actually did this thing and it helped the pain go down and I didn't feel that panic, right? Because I think that's really what we all get to, is this place of panic where it's just like, ah, oh, I can't get this pain to go down. What's gonna happen? My head's gonna explode, or my neck's gonna fall off, or, you know, whatever. And as soon as we get into that cycle, it actually will just perpetuate our pain further. Yeah. Because then we're just flooding our system with all these fear messages and stuff. Totally. So I just generally go right back to the thing that helps me the most, which is usually bending my knees up, getting my low back resting on the ground, placing hands on my low ribs and taking a couple big deep breaths into my hands, tightening kind of my low rib cage down and kind of trying to just sit tall through my neck. And even just doing that and sitting here, I can feel like a nice stretch down my back in the place that is the stretch or the hurt so good for me. And inevitably after 5 or 10 of those breaths, my symptoms will recede or go down, which makes sense to me as a doctor, as somebody who knows kind of the physiology of what's going on, and really empowers me as a person who deals with pretty bad pain sometimes.
100%. And do you think some of that breath work that kind of really helps to reduce some of those symptoms isn't just physiologically speaking, but also
positionally? Yeah.
Well, and also mentally. I mean, you've had trauma. You've been in an accident, you know? Yeah. That is a traumatic thing for the body and for the mind.
Yeah. And when we think about, you know, neck pain or upper neck pain, I mean, one of the reasons a lot of us hold so much tension around there is because as soon as we're stressed, boom, our shoulders go into our ears. And so again, the breath, when I do focus on that long exhale, it immediately gives me that physiologic flip to the parasympathetic, which we've also had a podcast on talking through how just focusing on that breath controls or gives me influence in my central nervous system for benefit to that pain, and positionally kind of gives me support in my core, helps me lengthen and relax through my upper back and neck muscles.
And how often are you doing this breath work?
Like twice a day, morning and night. I mean, my thing—
At least.
Right? And my thing is, set the state and then clean the slate. At the morning, in the morning, I wake up. Let's set the state with some breath work. Let's get ourselves to calm down, prime those positions, and then no matter what crap we go through during the day, we're gonna end the day by cleaning the slate, giving ourselves that influence back, calming that system back down, and getting ourselves ready for bed. So two of the things I do the most that when I don't do, I notice the difference is some sort of morning and nighttime breath work.
100%. And believe me, like, this isn't just him saying this, like, it happens.
Yeah. I mean, this morning I came out to do some of my breath work and then fell back asleep and got a nice another little half hour nap in. So that was good.
Your body needed it,
right?
Clearly.
Clearly I did need it. And the breath work helps me understand emotionally, mentally, physically, helps me hone in on some of those things I might need. So it benefits in all sorts of areas.
So many.
Yeah.
And just to touch on real quick too, like, what are some of the other practices foundationally that you're doing, like from the feet up, to really help support the body?
So the feet are so important, and that's some place that through kind of this pattern we've been talking about with the real wide hips, my knees landing slightly inside, my feet were slightly out, and that was because I never really had full dorsiflexion, what we call, or our foot going up towards our shin in the front, right? And that caused me to compensate again through the knees, or was a part of that chain, knees to hips to feet, you know, and all the way back. So things that I've been doing lately to really focus on the feet, one is wearing my barefoot shoes. Mm. You know, I'd say that has helped so much because it kind of makes my feet do the work that they're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. They're flat, they're thin, they're flexible. So my feet can't hide from that motion that they should be getting through all of the movement. So I love using the Vivos because they help my feet really
sink and connect into the ground and spread the toes out where they need to work in their kind of toe box. So that's one big thing, because the shoes that I was wearing, and when I think back on, you know, football and basketball and baseball, they really just bind up the foot. And they were so tight. We always had Nike team shoes, and Nikes are inherently some of the thinner shoes. I'm sure there are Nikes that might be wider, but it'd be the thinner shoes that would not let my feet do those things and kind of perpetuate this pattern of really high rigid arches and a lack of dorsiflexion.
And a lack of toe mobility. Now that you've been working on your toes, you actually have that space in the toe box. And how long have you been wearing the Vivos now?
So the Vivo's over probably a year and a half now. Woo. And I'm just getting to the point where I feel comfortable wearing them every day. I feel comfortable running in them for short bouts, working out in them. So initially, that's another thing that's important to focus on, is not just going right to a barefoot shoe and running in that all day, because our foot might not be ready for that based on what we've been doing.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. And I know, like, speaking as your partner too, like, you doing your practices is super inspiring, because again, guys, like, he is consistent. like I'm telling you. And when you're not consistent, like,
I can tell.
Yeah, you can tell, like, emotionally, physically, how you feel in your body and how you're able to, like, really take on the day. And I know, even, like, you were saying you like to climb trees, and that's a new quarantine activity that started coming out now that the gyms are closed and everything. Mm-hmm. But you also would be up in your tree doing your ankle mobility and everything, and your consistency with it, and, like, your consistency with putting the socks in the toes and wearing your Vivos and working on your breath work and doing your core foundational stuff and your handstands. Even, like, his alignment for his handstands is unreal at this point. Like, it used to be a really lack of shoulder like flexibility, thoracic flexibility, and your low back would be just, like, super arched. Yeah. And now it's, like, night and day. Like, we definitely need a before and after of that handstand.
Well, thanks for that. And it's, like, I only do those things not because it, like, looks good from the outside to, like, do your daily things, or not because everyone says you should do your five daily things in the morning routine. It's because, truly, like you said, when I don't do them, I don't feel as good. My body has more pain. I don't sleep as well. You know, my mindset suffers. So it's just, doing those daily habits truly helps me create that consistent shift. It helps me shift that resting state of my body. And I think that's where I don't think I'm seeing as much change in my handstand work, because I'm pounding the handstand exercises. In reality, I'm not upside down nearly as much as I should be if I want to get really good at the handstand. I think my handstands have been improving significantly because I'm opening up my upper back a lot more, and I'm able to extend to get myself stacked over my hands and my shoulders. So again, I think these improvements are coming foundationally a lot more than they're coming from the high level exercise. So
exactly.
Yeah. Had I not been doing a lot of that stuff, I don't think that progress would be happening.
100%. This isn't fun. I think this will really help a lot of people, like, just within their own journeys, because that's the thing that I always tell people. It's like, well, how long will it take me to recover from this? How long will it? It's a journey.
If we go through my rap sheet, like, I tore something really bad in my left foot. I have had surgery on my right knee that I, you know, have a similar injury on my left knee. Double surgeries for the inguinal hernias. Consistent upper back and neck pain. Right torn rotator cuff, left separated AC joint. It happens.
Yeah.
Shit happens. I'm sorry, guys. Like, and so we can let those things sit and define us, and we can sit in those places, or we can find the path that best influences our body to be able to continue to advance and optimize the way we move. And I choose that path. So I think a great place to end and just tell you, like, you can do something. And this podcast is a lot about just helping you find that something.
Thank you again for joining us on yet another PT Pearl. We just appreciate you so much. And of course, if you need more visuals for each PT Pearl, they are over at Doc Gen Fit on YouTube. There is a whole section for the PT Pearls from the Optimal Body Podcast that you can use to really see what we're talking about. And don't forget, if you really like this, if you're learning from it, share it out. Share it with your community. Tell us what you're learning. Rate and subscribe to the episode, because there's going to be so many more goodies and PT pearls along the way. And if you're ready to dive in even deeper, don't forget, we have an Optimal Body membership with an incredible community of movers learning with us and moving in their body. Until next time, thank you.